Former Trump lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen told Congress he fears that Trump won't peacefully give up the White House if he loses. What does the Constitution say about that?
When I was researching the book, I was really curious in asking, you know, how well is our system of constitutional and federal law prepared to deal with an incumbent in the White House who rejects electoral defeat? And I think the short answer is the system is not particularly well designed to deal with something like that.
That's legal scholar Lawrence Douglas. We talk with him about his book, Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. Then, how can we make sure that kids grow up understanding their right to freedom of speech? We talk with free speech attorney Jessica Bohr about the children's book she co-wrote with her father, Sandy Bohr, also a free speech attorney. The book is Your Voice is Your Superpower, A Beginner's Guide to Freedom of Speech and the First Amendment. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. The upcoming election could very well see the death of American democracy. Donald Trump has essentially told the nation he will never accept electoral defeat. It doesn't require a strong imagination to get a sense of the mayhem he will unleash if he loses a closely contested election. With millions of diehard supporters believing that their dear leader has been toppled by malignant forces of the deep state, Trump could remain a force of constitutional chaos for years to come. Lawrence Douglas's book, Will He Go?, explores how the constitutional crisis could play out in, for example, the case of a delayed vote count over absentee ballots, or Republican legislatures interfering with the Electoral College, or with hacking of the vote by nefarious players here and abroad. Lawrence Douglas is professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College in Massachusetts. In addition to Will He Go?, he's the author of The Right Wrong Man, John Demjanjuk, and The Last Great Nazi War Crimes Trial. Well, Lawrence Douglas, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Pleasure to be with you, Francesca.
It's called In the Battle Over the U.S. Supreme Court, Democrats Can Still Have the Last Laugh. So how can Democrats have the last laugh?
Well, I think the way they could have the last laugh is if they pack the court. And as you might remember from studying history, back in the 1930s, in 1937, then-President Franklin Roosevelt was very frustrated with a very conservative Supreme Court that was declaring New Deal laws unconstitutional. And he then came up with the brilliant idea of increasing the number of Supreme Court justices from 9 to 15. At the time, the Supreme Court had, I think, these six justices who were in the 70s. And so Roosevelt thought, well, these poor septuagenarians, they need some help with their workload. So for everyone over 70, I will get to nominate a new member to the court. Now, this was a pretty transparent effort to pack the court to arrive at some kind of political result, namely a court that would uphold New Deal legislation. But in this case, I really do think that if Trump and McConnell are successful in getting another member onto the Supreme Court before the election, or at least before a new president is inaugurated, then the Democrats, should they capture the White House and the Senate, they really should increase the number of members of the Supreme Court from, let's say, the current 9 to 11. And that would simply be a rectification for the kind of abuse of constitutional rules that led to Gorsuch's appointment to the court. Again, this was back in 2016, and now a possible replacement for Justice Ginsburg. So I don't think that would be an example of Democrats, you know, playing fast and loose in the same way as the Republicans, as much as them kind of engaging in a necessary act of kind of constitutional restoration, given the Republicans' attack on the norms of the confirmation process.
And how was Gorsuch's nomination a violation of constitutional rules?
So if you recall, so back in 2016, in February of 2016, this is when Justice Scalia died. So this is about 8.5, close to 9 months before the presidential election. And President Obama nominated a very qualified and quite moderate judge, Merrick Garland, to replace Justice Scalia. And at the time, Mitch McConnell said, no, the American people should have the voice in the selection of the next Supreme Court justice, so we're not going to fill this vacancy until we have a new president. And he refused to so much as give Merrick Garland a hearing. And you'd actually have to go back, I think it was about 150-year period from 1866 to 2016. The Senate had never once prevented a president from ultimately filling a Supreme Court vacancy. So McConnell crafted this new rule, and then ultimately we've seen him turn his brand new rule that presidents don't get to nominate new justices in an election year. Well, now apparently that rule now has an amendment built into it, namely Republican incumbents in election years get to fill Supreme Court vacancies, but Democrats don't.
Right. I think we should move on to your book now, because whatever happens with the Supreme Court, there's a whole big election that is happening before the next term, and all of this is pretty relevant. In fact, the Supreme Court itself could be quite relevant. This is a terrific book. Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. Terrific and terrifying at the same time. You begin this book by saying this is about the clear and present danger of transitioning from democracy to authoritarianism. The peaceful succession of power. You say that our Constitution does not secure that peaceful succession of power. It predisposes it. Could you explain that?
Yeah, presupposes it. Yes, it presupposes it. So I think what I was trying to say there was that the Constitution basically kind of assumes that there's going to be a peaceful succession of power. So I think when I was researching the book, I was really curious in asking, you know, how well is our system of constitutional and federal law prepared to deal with an incumbent in the White House who rejects electoral defeat? And I think the short answer is the system is not particularly well designed to deal with something like that. And, you know, in a certain way, it's very hard for constitutional systems to prepare themselves for incumbents who reject basic norms of that constitutional system. It seems that all legal systems always kind of presuppose that there's some kind of deeper normative framework that the players in that system subscribe to. And if they don't subscribe to that deeper normative framework, then the system can be very, very vulnerable, I fear.
And of course, we have the attacks on the normative framework predate Trump, but have been greatly accelerated by him, predate him from the side of the GOP, as you point out in the book. I mean, for example, Democratic governors who were elected where there are Republican legislatures, those Republican legislatures stripped the governorship of crucial powers. So it's not just Trump. It is the entire Republican Party. You consulted a number of experts and asked them to give on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely did they think there would be a constitutional crisis because of this election? And most of them gave it a 9. One even said, is there an 11? What were some of the reasons that they gave you?
Well, the thing that we also need to kind of bear in mind, Francesca, is when I was asking these experts to kind of assess the dangers of this coming election, this is before COVID. And I think COVID has really upped the stakes. So I think if I went back to the same folks that I spoke to at the time when I was researching the book and asked the same question, we'd be up to the 12 and 13s and 14s by now, because I really do think the dangers are very, very real. And I think a lot of the the concerns that people had, and these concerns, I think, have only been borne out by the president's most recent comments. Their concerns was that we have a president who basically has created a kind of, you know, maybe I can describe it as a heads I win, tails you lose electoral scenario, in which he's basically told the American people that the only way for our electoral system to demonstrate its integrity is if I win. And if I lose, then it becomes evidence of the fact that the system is rife with fraud and corruption. And we've never before had that in American history. We've never before had a president telling the American people that our electoral system is unreliable and corrupt. And of course, he's done this without any evidence whatsoever. And obviously, he's specifically targeted mail-in ballots.
Yes, he has. On the other hand, I wonder if one reason he's doing that is because COVID has so clearly shown his unfitness for office, his utter and complete lack of concern for the health and welfare of the American people, and that therefore it's more likely that he would lose in an election. So does that give you any hope for a better outcome?
You know, in a way it does, but it also raises my concerns as well. And the reason I say that is I think you're absolutely right. I think his epic failure of leadership with regards to the COVID pandemic has certainly made him into a far more vulnerable candidate. And the prospect of him losing is that much higher. At the same time, the COVID pandemic has also guaranteed that this election is going to be conducted under very unusual circumstances. And I think under the best of circumstances, this election would have been a stress test for American democracy, given the posturing of the president. But given the fact that he is both vulnerable and the fact that this election is going to be a deeply anomalous one, I think it just kind of creates all the more reason to worry that this guy is a kind of a cornered animal who is really willing to engage in constitutional brinkmanship and basically willing to, you know, make for a lot of mayhem and chaos in this nation in order to protect himself politically.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Lawrence Douglas about his book, Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. One of the things you do in the book that I think is very useful is that you outline what most authoritarian elections are like. So I wonder if you could do that and then say how this might be different.
One of the things I try to point out is we obviously live in a constitutional democracy that for 230 years has displayed remarkable and impressive stability. And that kind of leads us to believe that, you know, the peaceful succession of power is just this inevitable thing that happens in the life of a democracy. And I was just trying to remind readers what a wonderful and also vulnerable achievement that is. Because when you see other kinds of states, authoritarian states that are transitioning to democracy, you very often see how difficult it is for these transitioning states to conduct not necessarily the first election, but the second election. And what I mean by that is, let's say you have an authoritarian state which is now trying to embrace a democratic future. In the first election, you often have, you know, these reformers who believe in the spirit of democracy, who are competing against each other in order to win the support of the people. But once one of these reformers gets into the position of power, their enthusiasm for democracy can wane. Because after all, the democratic process has already put this person in power. This person doesn't have a whole lot to gain by now placing their political fortunes back in the hands of the people. And so very often when it comes to that second election, when the incumbent is now up for re-election, that's where we see all these kind of shenanigans taking place in which people now try to hold on to power through the corruption of the democratic process. And our nation, of course, has been happily immune to that. And unfortunately, I think that this election is putting kind of the pressures on our electoral system that we really haven't seen in our history, except maybe, you know, at a couple of times, like maybe 1876 and the year 2000.
One critical fact in those elections, for example, in Turkey and elsewhere, is the role of the military and the intelligence forces and the police being basically being captured by the executive in a way that they become the force to maintain the leader's power. But in this case, I think probably only the police are in that position, which is serious enough. But the military and the intelligence forces, I mean, as you point out, Donald Trump has done everything he can to alienate them. Do you think that this is a critical factor in our favor?
I certainly think it's, you know, a factor. In the book, I describe Trump as a kind of weak authoritarian. And by weak authoritarian, it really has nothing to do about his personal political style. I mean, I think he has pretty deep authoritarian instincts, and they've been pretty richly on display for the last, you know, 3.5 years. But exactly as you point out, one of the things that's kind of remarkable about him is that most authoritarians try to cultivate very strong ties with the state's military and intelligence apparatus, and Trump has done nothing but alienate the top military brass and the leaders of the intelligence agencies. Where we do find him enjoying support is in things like in border security services. They seem to support him quite aggressively. And it's also possible that local police support him quite aggressively. So I do think that that places some check on his most authoritarian impulses.
The military said that they won't interfere in the case that he would leave. Do you think that that's just something they have to say now? Or, I mean, maybe I'm just grasping at straws, but do you have any opinion on that?
Well, you know, I really don't imagine come, let's say, the day after Inauguration Day, I don't imagine on January 21st, if Biden has been duly inaugurated on January 20th. And my book is not kind of like a sequel to 7 Days in May. Like, I don't necessarily assume that the military are going to have to frog march Trump out of the Oval Office where he's kind of barricaded himself. So I think the military is not in the position of deciding who the commander-in-chief is. The military is in the position of obeying the orders of the commander-in-chief. So I do believe that the military would be very faithful to President Biden. You know, the question, of course, can arise, and this is obviously a very speculative scenario, about what the military would be willing to do between, let's say, November 3rd and January 20th, should Trump invoke something like the Insurrection Act of 1807 to deal with, you know, the possible specter of, you know, some kind of domestic unrest.
And yet, many people think that it is only if millions of people go into the streets to protest his, you know, refusal to accept the results of an election should Biden win, that is the only check on his power, since the GOP refuses to do that. What's your sense on that?
Well, this gets pretty granular. It gets a little detailed. But, you know, we kind of really have to kind of think through what happens between November 3rd and, let's say, January 20th. Because it is certainly possible that we could imagine Trump having a lead on November 3rd. And the only reason I say that is there was a poll that was released, I think, on August 26th that indicated that about 20% of Trump's voters expect to vote by mail-in ballot, whereas about 60% of Biden's voters intend to vote by mail-in ballot. And given the discrepancy between those camps, it's easy to imagine that Trump could have a lead on November 3rd. And what my fear is that he would then try to leverage that lead into a claim that he's been reelected. And that as that lead evaporates with the count of the mail-in ballots, he'll try to do what we've already seen him preparing himself to do, namely argue that the mail-in ballots are unreliable and corrupt. And it is possible that you could have, you know, Republican lawmakers in various states support him in those claims. And I think a lot is going to turn, Francesca, on just how decisive he loses. That is, if he loses very decisively with the count of mail-in ballots, I do think his opportunities to really trigger a deeper constitutional crisis will be limited. But if it is the case that the count of the mail-in ballots ends up being pretty tight in a handful of swing states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, then I really could imagine his electoral defiance gaining a lot of traction. And by that, I mean not simply among his supporters, but among GOP lawmakers. And that really could create a crisis for our nation.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Lawrence Douglas about his book, Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. Lawrence Douglas, go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Will He Go? Next up, teaching kids about free speech. Stay tuned after the break. You have three scenarios. One is titled, The System Cannot Protect Itself. You say there are three key dates. That's November 3rd, December 14th, and January 6th. Why the latter two? Why are they so key?
Right. So I think most Americans think that the only relevant day in a presidential election is election day itself. But in fact, what happens in this election season on December 14th, this is when the electors in all the states would actually go to their state capitals and cast their electoral college votes. Now, of course, that also presupposes that the state has already figured out who has carried their state. And then on January 6th, that's the day when the electoral certificates, which have been cast by the electors in all 50 states and also in the District of Columbia on December 14th, that's when on January 6th, in a joint session of Congress, these electoral certificates are opened and basically counted by the members of Congress. And that's when you really have a person declared the winner of the election. That's when you really have a president and vice president elect. And typically that joint session of Congress on January 6th is a rather, you know, pro forma ceremonial exercise. But if it is the case that you have contested results in swing states, which are going to be determinative of the electoral count outcome for the nation, then suddenly that can become a very, very contentious session of Congress. And we've seen that happen before. We've seen it most notably and disastrously back in 1876 in the Hayes-Tilden election.
What happened then? And talk about the Supreme Court and their role.
Right. So maybe the two elections to focus on are where things really went sideways, 1876 and then also 2000. So in 1876, you had three separate states, Florida, South Carolina, and Louisiana, submitting competing electoral certificates to Congress. And by competing electoral certificates, I simply mean that the states couldn't decide who had carried their state. At the time, the 1876 election was between the Republican Rutherford B. Hayes and the Democrat Samuel Tilden. And because the states couldn't decide who had won, and the election depended on the outcome of the votes in those three states, Congress was thrust in the position of trying to sort out who had won the Hayes-Tilden election. And Congress, and this will no doubt sound familiar, Congress itself was divided between a House that was controlled by Democrats and a Senate that was controlled by Republicans. And given the divisions within Congress, Congress found itself stalemated. And so we had a real electoral crisis. And that electoral crisis wasn't resolved until 2 days before the planned inauguration. And at the time, the incumbent president, Ulysses S. Grant, he was so concerned that Tilden and Hayes were going to stage their own competing inaugurations on Inauguration Day that he considered declaring martial law. And the electoral crisis was solved only by a compromise that really was a catastrophe for the black citizens of the United States. Basically, it was a compromise in which the Republican Hayes ultimately won, but in return for a promise that the Republicans would remove federal troops from southern states, which basically paved the way for the rise of Jim Crow. So the result of that electoral crisis of 1876 is not a particularly happy precedent. And then, of course, there was the mess in the year 2000.
And, you know, it's interesting. I've always felt that Al Gore should have contested that because he won. I mean, there was a recount months later that showed that he won Florida. And the outcome has been disastrous. When we think of the, you know, trillions of dollars spent on war, the hundreds of thousands of American soldiers wounded, the millions of people abroad, the societies that have broken down. And the same thing with Trump. I mean, if Trump gets back into office and is not elected there, but does it by hook or by crook, we have 7 years to tackle the climate issue or we're done. We will not have a habitable planet for our children, much less our grandchildren. The stakes are incredibly high. It's not just about the Constitution.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I think the climate politics are, yeah, it's an absolutely, it's an existential issue. And yeah, I think it would be a catastrophe for the country if he manages to create electoral chaos in the coming months. And it would obviously be a catastrophe of a different order if he simply gets reelected, if somehow he wins. And of course, a lot of this we wouldn't even be worrying about if we didn't have this anachronistic and dysfunctional method of electing a president, you know, relying on the Electoral College.
So you're also concerned, scenario two, about a hack attack. Tell us about that.
Well, in the book, I basically just tried to kind of game out three possible scenarios that could lead to an electoral meltdown. And one of the things that we have in our country is an incredibly decentralized way of electing a president. We don't really have a federal or nationalized election system. Everything is left up to the states. Now, there have been various concerns raised about the vulnerability of our system to being hacked, let's say, by a foreign adversary such as Russia. Now, one possible upside of the fact that we have such a decentralized election system is it's very difficult for, let's say, some malicious adversary to engage in a global attack on the system. Because again, we don't have a generalized system. Everything is left up to states and to localities. But that said, that strength is also a weakness, because really what it means is that all an adversary has to do is target a particularly vulnerable area of a particularly important swing state. And the dividends for that malicious adversary could be incredibly great, because they could succeed at gumming up the entire election. So one thing that I imagined is, you know, again, it's not an inconceivable scenario that Michigan turns into the key swing state in the coming election. But if you had, let's say, a targeted hack of Wayne County, where Detroit is, that basically could end up meaning that hundreds of thousands of voters who would probably end up voting for Biden would be unable to vote on election day. And that could mean that Trump ends up carrying Michigan, and then Trump carries the nation by carrying Michigan. And then, you know, you have to ask the question, well, what kind of recourse do we have in place? What is our plan B if it is the case that, you know, Wayne County is knocked out on election day? And the short and startling answer is we don't have a plan B. United States, we really don't have a plan B that would let us troubleshoot a situation like that. Now, we could always try to make something up. We could always try to decide, well, maybe there'll be a revote. But would the revote be just for Wayne County? Would it be all of Michigan? Would it be the entire United States? I mean, all these things would be litigated. And of course, they'd be litigated against the backdrop of a president who was vehemently and constantly tweeting that I have been reelected And now Democrats are just trying to steal my victory by blaming a power failure or a failure of voting machines in Detroit on the Russians.
Which is maybe why voting by mail is a good idea in places like that.
Absolutely. I mean, the voting by mail, again, is voting by mail absolutely a fail-safe method of voting? No, it's not necessarily absolutely fail-safe. But I recall the charges that Trump has leveled against the integrity of mail-in ballots are entirely baseless. I mean, they haven't been supported by any evidence whatsoever. And there are, you know, various ways of safeguarding even electronic voting machines by creating paper ballot trails. But, you know, I think about 1 in 10 votes that are going to be cast in this upcoming presidential election will leave no paper trail. So if you ever had to audit the election results, you wouldn't be able to recreate it in about 10% of the votes cast in the United States.
Which is another reason for a mail-in ballot. Although I have to say, I have decided not to do a mail-in ballot. I have decided to vote early in New York State. New York State has terrible problems with absentee ballots. I think 20% of them were rejected during the primaries. So I'm just going to suit up with a face shield and a N95 mask and go and vote early.
Well, good for you, because I do think, you know, one of the things also is for states that do have, that do provide for early voting, hopefully when the voting is spread out over a number of days, then the health risks associated with voting on any particular day will be, you know, dramatically reduced, because it's not going to be like on November 3rd, where potentially you could have these very, very long lines. And then, you know, there are other opportunities for people who will be doing mail-in ballots to, instead of relying on the USPS, as we've seen Trump trying to, in a sense, disable the USPS as a way, again, of kind of casting doubts on the integrity of mail-in ballots by guaranteeing that they aren't submitted in a timely fashion. There are, you know, many localities that provide for these drop boxes, where you, instead of, again, relying on the USPS for your mail-in ballot, you can kind of bring it to a secure drop box and deposit it there.
And even where there are not secure drop boxes, which we don't have in New York State, when I was still planning on voting absentee, I was going to travel all the way, which is an hour and 15 minutes away, to the Suffolk County Board of Elections and personally hand in my ballot, absentee ballot, early, make sure that the signature matched, make sure that the thing was registered as voted. So there are multiple ways of doing things, but it's going to take a lot of extra work, which is always difficult in a country in which only a minority of eligible voters actually vote. Hopefully that'll be different this time. Now, finally, the only real check is a landslide. Is that right?
Yes. And of course, you know, we even have to think about what a, you know, landslide would mean, or at least a very decisive defeat of Trump, because obviously it doesn't mean simply a decisive defeat in the popular vote, because thanks to our bizarre way of electing a president, you can win the popular vote pretty decisively and still lose the Electoral College vote. We obviously saw that happened in 2016. We also saw it happen in year 2000, a little less decisive Gore's victory, but nonetheless, he won the popular vote over George W. Bush by over 500,000 votes. Again, far less than Clinton's 3 million vote victory over Trump in 2016. But he would have to be defeated decisively in the Electoral College. And I, again, would probably even go further than that and say he would have to be beaten decisively in the swing states, and that decisive defeat would have to become, I think, clear pretty early on after the election. That is, probably not on November 3rd itself, but hopefully within just a few days after the election, we already see the trend, the unmistakable trend, that Biden is building up a big, big lead in the mail-in ballots. And even under those circumstances of a decisive defeat, I believe that Trump would still try to blame the defeat on fraud and corruption. I don't see him ever conceding in the sense of recognizing the legitimacy of his defeat. But I do think that he would have to, as a real world matter, have no other opportunity than to submit to defeat, because I do think his ability to really kind of create chaos would be limited, because if he loses really, really badly, I imagine a lot of GOP lawmakers are going to abandon ship quickly, and that will limit his ability to kind of create this deeper constitutional crisis.
Let's hope that that is the outcome of the election. Lawrence Douglas, your book is so timely, so important, and it's a fascinating read. Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. Thank you so much for talking with us here about this existentially important issue.
Thanks so much for having me, Francesca. The questions are terrific, and I really enjoyed the conversation.
Lawrence Douglas. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Will He Go? Next up, teaching kids about free speech. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. You can't protect democracy if you don't know what it means. When I was a kid, we had civics in elementary school, where we learned about the Constitution, the balance of powers between the three branches of government, and the First Amendment and the right of free speech. But how many kids get civics in school today or learn about free speech? Probably too few. Jessica Bohr and her dad, Sandy Bohr, both free speech lawyers, set out to right that wrong. Their book, Your Voice is Your Superpower, is a beginner's guide to freedom of speech and the First Amendment pitched to grade school kids. In a series of charming illustrations and text, it shows kids why our voice matters, how we can use it, and also why we must protect everyone's right to free speech. Well, Jessica Bohr, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
This book, Your Voice is Your Superpower, is pitched to the lower grades, say 4 to 7, but it has a list of resources in the back that makes it valuable for readers of any age.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the concept of freedom of speech is something that's equally challenging for young children and grown-up, but it's equally important. And so our hope is that both the children and the grown-ups who are reading the book alongside them will be able to gain some new insights and really spend just a little bit of time thinking about the importance of freedom of expression and what it means today.
And you are on the Leadership Council of the Committee to Protect Journalists. In fact, a portion of the proceeds of the book are being donated to them. What's the connection between the work of that committee and your decision to make this book, to create the book?
Well, my dad, who's my co-author, and I are both First Amendment lawyers who spend the majority of our time defending the rights of journalists and other free speakers out there in the world. And I began working with the Committee to Protect Journalists, I think about 4.5 years ago. I feel very strongly about the work they do. They work to defend the rights of journalists to have freedom of speech, freedom of the press worldwide. Increasingly, they've had to turn their efforts here into the U.S. as well because of the threats to free speech and freedom of assembly in the United States. So we thought it would be a nice connection to the work that we do as lawyers and the work that I do really just as an independent individual helping the Committee to Protect Journalists to draw the connection between the book, which is helping young readers learn about freedom of speech and support the efforts that CPJ does supporting freedom of speech worldwide. It's a really fantastic organization, and as you can imagine, really crucially important these days, the work that they do.
Now to the book itself. You stress, first of all, that people have a right to talk, you know, the freedom of speech, but also the freedom to not talk. So why did you counterpoise the two? Why did you include the two, basically, in the beginning pages of this book, Your Voice is Your Superpower?
I think it's a really important concept that sometimes perhaps might be overlooked, that the power in free speech, some of that comes from your ability to choose how to use your voice. And I think it's important to understand that sometimes that means being quiet, and sometimes it means being loud, and sometimes it means that you feel like you're not meant to be part of a conversation, and all of those things are okay. And I think the related concept that we also talk about a little bit in the book as well is that freedom of speech requires active speakers, but it also requires active listeners. So our hope is that readers of the book will start to understand a little bit more clearly the importance of being a speaker and also being a listener, because I think the better you are at both of those things, the more productive dialogue we can have, and the more fulfilling democracy we can create and live in. You know, of course, this is about speech in its various forms, right? So it's about speaking, it's about writing letters, it's about protesting, it's about whatever form of expression you feel comfortable and you feel passionate about using and engaging in. But I think it really is important to listen and to allow other people to express their viewpoints so that you can really be a democratic community.
Yes, but that gets into some very thorny issues, which you don't really explore, but you do allude to in this book, Jessica Bohr, that you co-wrote with your dad, Sandy Bohr. Your voice is your superpower. You say free speech can be tricky, but you kind of leave it there. First of all, I want to ask you what you mean, and then why did you kind of leave that just as it is?
I think free speech certainly can be tricky. So we said it because it's definitely one of the important elements of learning about the concept. It can be tricky because sometimes it can be hard to listen to people you disagree with, right? And so it can be very challenging to hear someone who's equally passionate about a subject that you are passionate about, but they're coming at it from an opposing or very different viewpoint. And so I think the concept that we wanted to introduce is that free speech belongs to everyone, right? So it's not just to you or to the people that you know or you grew up with or who you like, your teachers, your parents, you know, for children who are the main audience of the book, but that everyone has the right. And that's why we all have it. It's sort of a circular argument, I guess, but I think it's a challenging concept, even for adults. I think the reason we didn't want to get too far down the road in this book is because the target age is 4 to 7 year olds for the most part, although I think you could probably go a little younger and a little older. And as you say, some of the exercises and resources we share can certainly be used by older audiences. But I think we didn't want to sort of bombard them with what can be really challenging conversation. So our hope is to sort of start the conversation here. And then as you become more comfortable with the concept, then hopefully they can sort of carry it forward. But I think it's really tough to get into a conversation with a four-year-old about the limitations on free speech, like whether you are allowed to say hate speech and some of the language. So we've kind of like left that for the next chapter, I guess.
What about hate speech or speech that spreads dangerous lies and misinformation? You, Jessica Bohr, as a First Amendment lawyer, what's your take on this complex issue?
Well, I mean, I think it's, as you say, I mean, it's very complex. I think what non-lawyers hate about answers from lawyers is, you know, an answer that I often give my reporters, which is when they ask me if they can do something and I say, it depends. You know, context is really important. And I think free speech is something that we're all entitled to in this society. Some of the conversations and the debates around free speech that you reference are in context where there may be other considerations that we might take into account, right? Like what's allowed in a public square versus what's allowed on Twitter. Are these the same things? Do you have the same rights to free speech? You know, for me personally, I think we should be worried about things that go beyond what is free and fair and open discourse, right? And I think inciting violence is beyond those boundaries. Spreading false information with the intent to harm people. These are things that go beyond what free speech is meant to protect, but it's really thorny territory, as you say. And I think what we're seeing too in some of these incidents and times that are transpiring these days are that free speech is something that can't be taken for granted, and we need to work to defend it. And while we're having those conversations, we have to come to a conclusion of what kind of speech we're willing to protect. And, you know, as I said, I think that the violence and putting people's lives at risk, those are some serious considerations. And that's not what free speech is meant to protect, but it's really challenging. And I'm certainly, you know, as a First Amendment lawyer, I'm very hesitant to put any restrictions on speech, but those are kind of the boundaries that I think about as being really important. And certainly who the speaker is and what the context is, right? What the impact of their speech might be.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Jessica Bohr about the book she co-wrote with her father, Sandy Bohr, Your Voice is Your Superpower, A Beginner's Guide to Freedom of Speech and the First Amendment. And not to get too far away from the book, but just one last question that I'm just burning to ask you. You know, many on the Supreme Court included, many on the right in this country believe that money equals speech. In fact, that's the basis of the whole Citizens United decision, that money equals free speech. As a First Amendment lawyer, what's your take on that?
I'm not really a fan of that argument myself, because I think part of the problem was the idea that it really kind of was granting organizations or corporations a right to free speech, which really, to me, I think extends beyond what the First Amendment has set out to do. It's really providing individuals the right to freedom of expression, freedom to assembly, you know, freedom of religion, freedom to express your grievances with the government. These are individual rights that we were granted under the First Amendment. So I think it really extended beyond that. I do think that where it was coming from, right, was more the concept that voting is a way of exercising your rights to freedom of speech and expression. And that I do believe in for individuals. But, you know, while in sort of an abstract way, where you put your money is a way of expressing yourself, I don't think that's meant to be sort of looped into the protections under the First Amendment. But I understand how they got there, I guess.
We are speaking with Jessica Bohr. This is Writer's Voice. She is the co-author with her father, Sandy Bohr, also a First Amendment lawyer, of the book Your Voice is Your Superpower. It is a beginner's guide to freedom of speech and the First Amendment that is oriented towards younger grade school children. Back to the book now. You said, you know, the right to redress one's grievances to one's government. And that is a theme that you, as the book unrolls, you get further into, often just through the graphic representation. For example, you have, you're free to kneel and free to stand, you know, free to sing in the shower and free to debate people in power. And these are, you know, the image you have is of athletes who are kneeling with a flag in another part of the frame there. You also say you're free to march, sign your name in a letter. So talk about some of the thinking around talking about activism to very young children.
Well, I think something that is particular, you know, the activism as something that's particularly relevant today when you look at what's happening in the streets of the United States, certainly with Black Lives Matter, but it extends to other debates that are happening within the U.S. these days, that a lot of people are bringing their children along. And in fact, some young children are actually organizing their own gatherings, their own protests, their own organized events to raise their voices in the community. I think what we're trying to do in the book is explain that there's a way for everyone to be engaged in their community, in their society, and that really can start from an early age. And I think what's important is that young people see that those actions, those expressions can lead to real change. And I think certainly there have been young leaders, not necessarily 4 years old, but I read about an 8-year-old who organized a Black Lives Matter protest in his town, and other young leaders who took the podium, you know, age 5, 10 years old. And I think it's really important for them to see and understand the power of their voice is real. And I think for parents and teachers right now, there's a lot of scary and challenging subject matter to talk about with young children. And I think it's really empowering to let them know that they have a way to face those things. And so if they're scared about what's happening to Black men and women with the police, and they start hearing about these stories and people of color who are treated a certain way, they have a way to raise their voice and talk about how that makes them feel. And I think like the way that a 5-year-old expresses himself may be different from the way that a 45-year-old does, but that's great. And they can participate in a march. They can write a letter to their school board or their principal or the president if they want to. And these things matter, you know, and they have an impact. And I think we tried to put as many tangible examples as we could in the book, but the idea is to just be actively engaged in your world. And even though when you're 5 years old, that world may seem a little bit smaller, right, than as you grow older, I think it's just really important to teach them to become engaged. And as you said, when we were talking at the beginning of our conversation, they also have the space to not be engaged. So if they don't want to be a part of a march, they can sit it out, you know, or if they don't want to write a letter, they don't have to. They can join a group or they cannot join a group. And I think what we're trying to do is create a space where they feel empowered to do all of those things.
Yeah, and now finally I'd like to circle back to the Committee to Protect Journalists and the threats to journalists, because we're speaking on a day when I believe it was just yesterday or the day before, another well-known and important journalist in Mexico was murdered. I believe he is the 7th already this year to have been murdered. And as you point out, threats, the United States is now one of the areas which is seen as where journalists are especially vulnerable. So I wonder if you could talk about the threats to journalists that are happening now and why are they getting worse? I mean, it does, I think I read something that said it's getting more and more dangerous to be a journalist. So I wonder if you could talk about that in general and then in the U.S. as well and what we can do to fight back.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think that it is true. I don't know if you could say it's definitely more dangerous to be a journalist now, but I think that the threats to journalists are changing. So I think when we used to think about the most dangerous places that a reporter or a photojournalist or an editor or a fact checker might be, we would think about them being on the front lines in a wartime setting. Right. And the dangers of being close to war and the military and armed conflict. And these days, one of the most challenging and dangerous places for a journalist can often be where there are protests and civil unrest, and perhaps even in their own country. So it's something that certainly is a concerning trend. And I think when governments turn from primarily democratic regimes to more authoritarian regimes, one of the first things they do is try to shut down the free press and the freedom of journalists. And so both as an advocate for journalists and an advocate for free speech in general, I personally watch these trends with a lot of fear and concern, because free speech and freedom of journalists to accurately report on the facts and to report on the government and hold them accountable, that's really how you protect the democracy. And so when we see crackdowns on those areas, it should be of concern to everyone, frankly. But certainly, I think seeing some of these brazen attacks on journalists, it's very frightening. The Committee to Protect Journalists works with a bunch of other free press organizations, and they have now in the U.S., I'm not sure if I'll get the name right, but it's a press freedom tracker where they keep track of infractions against the free press in the United States. And they have been tracking what's been going on since the Black Lives Matter protests began and what's been happening in terms of attacks on journalists, confiscating equipment, being shot with rubber bullets and being shot with tear gas and all of the things that you've, I'm sure, seen in the reports. And it's quite troubling. So I think like the things we see when we look around the world, sometimes might feel abstract, like it's happening far away. But we should be watching those things because they can come quite close to home. And as you say, we're seeing this stuff extend to the U.S. And I think it's very saddening, I suppose, but it is really important to pay attention. And in terms of what you can do, certainly you can watch for any kind of legislation that's coming up, which has come up that restricts on freedom of the press. We see that around the world where they're enacting laws that are meant to attack free speech. It used to be, today, obviously, when we're speaking, it's 9/11. In the post-9/11 world, countries were passing laws under the guise of protecting against terrorism, which would restrict freedom of speech and freedom of the press in particular. And now we're seeing that in terms of protecting against COVID and in a healthcare emergency. So governments will often use the state of emergency or declare a state of emergency as a way to sort of crack down on speech. And really, you know, in my view, obviously, it's an excuse to have a little bit of a firmer grasp on what the press is able to do. And certainly, I'm sure you've been following what's happening in Hong Kong. And I think the lesson when we watch these stories is that how quickly something can go from what may be a free and democratic press to a really restricted regime where journalists really are not able to do their jobs.
Yes, and I think that's such an important thing to point out, and really does then point to the importance of starting early in educating children about what it means to have this right of free speech. And you do that so well and so charmingly in your book, Your Voice is Your Power, A Beginner's Guide to Freedom of Speech and the First Amendment, which you, Jessica Bohr, wrote with your dad, Sandy Bohr. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jessica Bohr is vice president and editorial counsel in the newsroom at Forbes. She serves on the leadership council of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to the Press Freedom Tracker for the U.S. to find out what exactly is the state of press freedom in our country now. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.